This is CKGI, Gabriola Co-op Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota.
Hello, everyone. My name is Naomi Beth Walken, and I am an essayist and the inaugural poet laureate of Nanaimo. This series of readings is called Bookmobile. They are my musings on books, writers, and the writer's life in the form of a mixture of essays and poetry that I call ESPO. I hope they will encourage your own writing and also suggest some books that you might like to dip into. The theme of this episode is travel writing.
Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, Beach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Louisville, Nashville, Knoxville, on Bobaka Shepherd.
Well, that was Johnny Cash's great I've Been Everywhere, Man. I haven't been quite everywhere, but I've certainly done my share of traveling by luxury liner, freighter, immigrant ship, bullet train, various sizes of aircraft, hitchhiking, and in our good old classic VW camper. I won't be speaking here of travel writing that covers such things as what to take with you, the artist's waterproof pen, the lined yellow pad of paper, Attila's hat, where not to go, or dangers and illnesses for which to prepare. Here I'm just considering why it's so much fun to read travel writing and why folk enjoy, in fact insist on writing while traveling or on vacation, whether it be a professional piece or a confessional diary. Even the dullest holidaymaker at least insists on sending home a photo of his cruise ship with the usual wish you were here piece of intelligence for his friends and family to ponder on. One doesn't need to go on a cruise liner or up the tributaries of the Amazon or into the deserts of Australia in order to write about traveling, however. A trip downtown or to the suburbs, if one lives downtown, can stir enough thought to get pen moving on paper. If you stay aware and alert, the car, bus, train, walk downtown can be fraught with all the anxieties of a trip to an Everest-based camp and with all the hedonistic pleasures of a beach in the Caribbean. Any shift in our environment, if we stay attentive, will bring a shift in consciousness, or at least that is what most of us hope when we plan to travel away from home base. Maybe I'm advocating close to home travel writing because of aging limbs and the preference for my own bed and refrigerator at this time in my life. A lot of the pleasure in travel writing is because traveling can, but doesn't always, give you a fresh perspective on life that you would like to share. You'll watch the skies more closely for colors of blue you haven't seen before, listen with fresh attention to sails slapping in the wind or the distant sounds of a gamelan orchestra, eating jellyfish in Japan or durian in Indonesia will certainly spark your taste buds to attention, and smelling the lavender fields of Provence will flood out any other smell you've ever smelled. By the way, have you ever dipped your hands into a bale of freshly sheared wool in New Zealand? Yes, it is the senses that make travel writing come alive. As Flannery O'Connor said, the beginning of human knowledge is through the senses, and through the senses is the way to inform your travel writing also. It's the sand between your toes, the ripe pineapple in your mouth, or the silk yardage at Jim Thompson's silk shop in Bangkok, slipping through your fingers. It's the description of these that will keep your readers on the edge of their seats, barely able to stop themselves ringing their travel agent for bookings. Travel writers really have to make one thing clear, and that is why one would want to visit, or at least want to read about, the place they are describing. They can focus on a special interest, crafts of the Maoris of Rotorua, New Zealand, theatre at Stratford, Ontario or UK, whale viewing at Tofino, British Columbia, art at the Guggenheim in Balboa. The writer could also be attracted and attract the reader by the historical associations with the place. Gold at Barkerville, pioneering days in the Australian outback, the Egyptian dynasties, the Heian court in Kyoto. Travel writing with sports as the focus pulls skiers to Whistler, kayakers to the West Coast, cyclists to France, and mountain climbers to the Himalayas. Food-focused travel writing attracts to the place whose palate is being described. Chinese, Thai, Japanese aesthetics, cowboy steaks, Italian pasta, and of course wines of France and Italy, Australia, BC and California. Take Ronald Wright's brilliant book on his travels in Peru, Cut Stones and Crossroads, in which he weaves Inca history, the Spanish conquest, and his own travels into a rich licla. His interest in folk music is another thread that winds through the book and makes his travel writing seem relevant and authentic. Lest this sound too serious, his wit and optimism keeps us from sinking with the campesinos who have become beggars in their own land. For example, instead of filling us with awe at his viewing of the ruins of Machu Picchu, he tells us that he neither ascended to the sun altar nor descended to the cave of the moon, but went straight to the restaurant and had a big breakfast, followed by eating the toast left behind by an elderly couple at the next table. This kind of travel writing pulls you willingly along as the writers share with their interests with intensity, trusting their enthusiasm will hook you to come along too. But there is also the travel writer who accentuates the hazards of the journey, the 100,000 prostrations on the way to Lhasa, as it were. It is the onerous rough path that transmutes, and you nod your head in agreement as you lie securely, cozied in your lounger, turning the pages as the travel saga draws you onward into the tale of unknown terrors and extreme physical testing. You don't need to love travel in order to be a travel writer. I know a crabby traveler who writes grumpy, complaining, often outrageous travelogues. She's not employed by a travel agency, that's for sure. They often hit a target. Her grumbling is usually softened by wit. Wit in travel writing should not be at the expense of the host country. But there is a problem with traveling, for first encounters depend on past prejudices, and often one does not get past the first encounter before one chooses to flee. This is a natural and animal reaction. However, if you're going to write about a country and its people, you need to get past the first to the second and third encounter, to fill the stranger out. After all, you are the stranger too. To see him or her affirmatively in the setting of the positives of their place. Some travel writers and also vacationers prefer to be well prepared before they go on a trip, and so they gather books and make notes, reading about the place to be visited certainly cuts down on the time taken in trying to locate things you want to see, customs you need to acknowledge, and right times to be there for festivals. But, on the other hand, it may tell you too much and you may lose freshness by being influenced by what you're reading. Seeing what you're going to see through another travel writer's eyes can be damaging. However, be warned that a little preparation may save your skin. My husband and I, eager to see the wonders of ancient Crete, didn't bother to read up on what was going on in present-day Athens, and so spent an uncomfortable night in a hotel there, while mobs of people ranged around outside, with loudspeakers bellowing some undecipherable exhortations, and the army and police presence very present. We never did find out what was going on, and so perhaps it was a case of innocence abroad, travelling unscathed. Another time we planned to travel from Australia to some islands, and found we had arrived on the islands late on a day when, for some reason, there was a curfew. People still on the streets after our arrival hour would apparently be stoned, I mean have stones thrown at them, if not shot. I was meant to go back to our New Zealand travel agent who booked that date and demand my money back, but somehow I never saw New Zealand again, as other travel plans crowded such a return out of the picture. The other juggling act beside deciding whether to pre-read or not pre-read is the decision as to whether to take notes while you're experiencing an event or not. To take notes is a sure way not to experience whatever is going on, but if you don't take notes, how are you going to remember details? Too many notes and you'll have no colour, nothing of your own depths being moved at what you're experiencing. Too few notes and the incident floats off without anchors. Did I mention the first sentence of a travel book? It must, of course, ensnare the reader. Paul Theroux's first sentence in his book, The Happy Isles of Oceania, is, "There was no good word in English for this hopeless farewell." You immediately wonder what on earth kind of journey he's off on, and under what circumstances, so you have to read the second sentence. My wife and I separated on a winter day in London, and we were both miserable, because it seemed as though our marriage was over. He finishes the book with his viewing of a total eclipse of the sun in Hawaii by saying, "Before the sun emerged again from its shadow, making the earth seem immeasurably grander than it had ever been before, I kissed the woman next to me, glad to be with her. Being happy was like being home." Wouldn't that induce you to read the 527 pages of Splashing Around Oceania with Mr. Thoreau in between those sentences? While the first sentence should be strong, going overboard with praise or criticism makes the reader suspicious. Is the writer protesting too much? After all, you will say, she is merely viewing a particular place at a particular time. A day later, or the day before, the scene could have been, will be, entirely different. I remember reading Janice Frawley Holler's book, Island Wise, in which she flits from island to island round the world, sand trickling between her toes, a margarita waving in her right hand, and not a cloud on the horizon. She also could be found with a lei around her neck, or sitting in a horse-drawn carriage which is clopping on the cobblestones to some quaint hotel or three-star restaurant. I remember feeling rather mean-spirited on the day I read this super positive feeling book, and so I wrote to her, asking her whether she'd come across any political uprisings of the underclass, gang rapes, clear cuts, kids rummaging through garbage heaps, etc., etc., on her travels to the islands. She actually replied and thanked me for liking her book. Authors can be so confused as to fan mail, I know. L. Pete O'Neill gives characteristics of a good travel writer. They include loves traveling, well-motivated, confident, friendly, curious, professional, researches well, has some knowledge of the natural sciences, history, geography, cultures, has writing and photographic ability, is healthy both physically, mentally, and emotionally. Well, you get the idea, but that lets most of us out, I'm afraid. Nevertheless, go for it, even if your faculties are a bit blunted and your skills tarnished. My favourite bit of travel writing? It's the first chapter of Jamaica Kincaid's book, A Small Place. It begins, if you go to Antigua as a tourist, and the rest is amazing and disturbing, and, although I've been to Antigua as a tourist, I will never go there again without feeling totally different because of this piece of writing. In fact, because of this book, I will never go anywhere again as a tourist or travel writer without feeling perhaps a little uneasy, and certainly trying to be much more aware of the culture and history of the country which I'm visiting.
A river ever changing as it flows, and the dreamer's just a vessel, must follow where it goes, trying to learn from what's behind you, never knowing what's in store. Each day's a constant battle just to stay between the shore. And I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry, like a bird upon the wind. These waters are my sky. I'll never reach my destination if I never try. So I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry. Too many times we stand aside, let the water slip away to what we put off till tomorrow. Now becomes today. Don't just sit upon the shoreline and say you're satisfied. Choose to chance the rapids and to dare to dance the tide. I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry, like a bird upon the wind. These waters are my sky. I'll never reach my destination if I never try. So I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry. There's bound to be rough waters, and I'll know I'll take some falls. With the good Lord as my captain, I can make it through them all. So I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry, like a bird upon the wind. These waters are my sky. I'll never reach my destination if I never try. So I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry. I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry.
River runs dry.
Till the river runs dry.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Reed, and you are listening to Gabriola Co-op Radio, my station, my island.
Here's a travel piece I wrote about a trip to Burma before it became Myanmar. It is based on my past interest in Buddhism and a curiosity about the monastery where a Buddhist teacher had trained. I called it Retreat to Burma. $120 in cash, 1,800 in traveler's checks, 1,040 baht. I hastily write down every penny that I have left in the world. It is 10 minutes before landing in Rangoon, and we've been presented with two customs forms to fill in duplicate. We land. My nose is streaming and I'm running a high temperature, but nothing is running as high as my temper, for here I am at yet one more customs desk, and this time a tough one, Burma. Everything I own in the world is in these two cloth bags. Writing down what remains of my cash makes me feel even more stripped and vulnerable. I remind myself that I'm on my way with Eli to meet my teacher's teacher. At his monastery, we'll sit in meditation for 7 days, the time we are allowed to stay in this country, and that is all that matters now. But wait, apparently I'm wrong, for the girl at the desk is looking fixedly at me and is holding her earlobes. I am perplexed, but touching my earlobes in imitation, I feel my earrings. My earrings! I pound my humble little bags with my fists and then wave my wedding ring at her. I shout, perhaps you want me to declare this too. Maybe you think I'm going to sell it. I'm shaking with rage, and even she can see that I'm more than a little distraught. She hastily brings additional forms and helps me fill in gold earrings, but it's too late. My first impression of Burma is rotten. She has her job to do, however, and stone-faced asks me, do you have anything else to declare? I turn my bags upside down on the counter. There are my patched trousers, my dingy panties, old shirts, and one faded dress. This, I yell at her, this is all I possess in the world. The hotel doesn't help lift my mood, nor do the mice and cockroaches. However, I remind myself that tomorrow is Eli's birthday, and we are to see our teacher's teacher. This evening we are going to the Shwe Dagon, the pagoda where our teacher was ordained, a place that my husband has waited years to see. The reason that I am in Burma has nothing to do with the Shwe Dagon and very little to do with my teacher's teacher. I'm tagging along because I'm more than a little interested in finding out whether I'm to be a monastery widow for just 7 days, for 3 years, 3 months and 3 days, or for the rest of my life. But first, the Shwe Dagon. Showering and putting on fresh clothes doesn't help my fever much, but it certainly cools my temper. We get a cab and are soon at the pagoda's base. There the scene is a cross between Lourdes and Niagara Falls. We struggle through soft drink vendors, picture postcard stands, masses of crudely carved Buddhas for sale, and all kinds of shoddy tourist junk. We take off our shoes and climb the steep stairs until we reach the Golden Bell itself. We stand in appropriate wonder at its immensity. I recall some facts set out for tourists. The lower part of the stupa is plated with 8,688 solid gold bars, the upper part with another 13,153. The crown or umbrella is tipped with 5,448 diamonds and 2,317 rubies. The very top is tipped with a 76-carat diamond, all to house 8 hairs of Gautama Buddha. I try not to be cynical. I'm happy for Eli's sake that he is here and that tomorrow is his birthday, which we will celebrate by going to the monastery. Next morning, I slip my little penknife under his mosquito netting and wish him good birthday. He plans to give his very valuable knife to the sayador, the head of the monastery, so I'm replacing it with my own. I shed a few internal tears, wondering whether this knife-giving precedes a severance. After breakfast, we wander down to the end of the road. An English-speaking gentleman stops to ask us if we need help. He not only calls a cab for us, but negotiates the fee and gives detailed instructions to the driver. I'm delighted, for when arriving at the monastery, the cab driver doesn't just dump us, but leads us along the walkways until all three of us are bowing at the Sayadaw's feet. Our teacher is well loved by his teacher, the Sayadaw, and we as his students are made very welcome. I immediately like the Sayadaw. He has very large boned face with ears sticking out at right angles. His loud voice hugs you and his eyes smile from within. He calls for a visiting nun to join us. She speaks perfect English and soon we are chatting away, filled with joy and contentment. Happy birthday, my dear husband. Suddenly we realize that the taxi driver is still with us, enjoying it all. We laugh, pay him and send him off with many thanks. We are in for a surprise. Here we have come via New Zealand to visit the Sayadaw, when in 5 days' time he himself will complete a similar circuit, America, Canada and New Zealand. We are shown all his travel plans, including private letters from all the centres that he will visit. Letters that certainly weren't meant to be shown to complete strangers. But there you are. That is the way with spiritual teachers. The Sayadaw has not only been a teacher, he's also been a builder. When he first came to this monastery, none of the pagodas and shrines that are there today existed. The nun told us that it is almost impossible to count the number of buildings that he has erected. One time she counts to 70, the next time to 73. The pagodas all contain Buddha statues, some standing and some sitting. They also house some amazing tableaux of carved and plastered figures resembling a Buddhist Madame Tussauds. The Sayadaw had a vision and he literally made it concrete. The nun is anxious for me to say morning prayers at the pagodas, and it is during this tour that I discover my lady. She is the only figure that attracts me. She is Dewa Saraswati, guardian of the Dharma books, and also of nuns. With her painted black curls, she looks like an Italian window dressing mannequin. What I like best about her is her gaudily painted costume and gold helmet. She has been loaded with junk jewellery and a strange pink lace shawl. During the week of our stay, I actually go and talk to her a few times on my own and decide to give her a little necklace that in my rage I'd forgotten to declare at customs and so will not have to account for on leaving. My lady's neck is rather large, so the nun places the necklace around the statue's wrist. I feel strangely serious about the gift and insist she place it so that its large blue stone is very noticeable. The nun adjusts it to please me and, in a whisper, asks me whether it is very valuable. It is not. There is a moment of strange gasping when, glancing up from a meditative moment, I notice monks' robes of saffron and dark red thrown over a bright yellow wall to dry. It is as if some faint movement of a creative urge is shifting inside me. Now is finally the day of the Sayadaw is leaving for Bangkok and North America. There is great excitement in the monastery compound. To add to it, a monk is being ordained. Last night he received his robes, and today we are all going over to the ordination hall to give him gifts, soap, washcloths, toothpaste, his few needs. The place is swarming with his children and grandchildren. On top of this, Sayadaw's benefactors arrive, bringing articles for him to take on his journey. He deals with it all joyously. The ordination hall on an adjoining lot is run down and wretched. Our own temple in the main compound is so spruce with all its colourful pagodas and liveliness, and yet somehow this temple seems closer to the essence of coming into being and passing away, and the suffering that comes from clinging to colourful pagodas. Back at our temple, the low tables are loaded with food. The women are shrieking and the children are running wild. Everyone is in great spirits. Suddenly, the new monk appears at the balcony and throws handfuls of candies. The children jump in the air, trying to catch them. The sayadaw is anxious to get going. He doesn't have to leave for the airport until 5:30, but the driver has already arrived at 1:00. Who can meditate? The departure is not to be missed. The nun and I sit chatting. She has decided to go to the airport with the party and then will return to stay with us until we leave. Finally, it's 5:00 and the procession starts to line up. Bimots, little half-ton trucks with their backs converted into seating, are for the monks. A Mercedes is provided for the sayadaw and his benefactors. The sayadaw gets into the lead car and they are off. We press our hands together in farewell and promise to see him again in 4 days' time in Bangkok. On the last day before we leave the monastery, I'm flipping through a book in a desultory manner when suddenly my eyes catch the words, "Now if we could be spared the suffering of sickness, old age and death, wouldn't we all choose to work towards nirvana?" Suddenly everything becomes very clear to me. I wouldn't. I don't want to work towards nirvana, whatever that state may be. I'm growing old and will soon be sick and die, and that's enough for me to work towards at the moment. I'm made of very ordinary stuff. When I hurt, I cry, and when I'm happy, I sing. I can't live up to the expectations of the nun, the monks, my husband, and particularly my old self. Even though the realization is no big deal, I feel an enormous relief. I'm sitting in this sweltering basement in a monastery in Rangoon, and at this moment, there's nowhere else I want to be. There is also no one else who will understand me, so I tell myself again, I am home, at home once more. I like to finish with a poem somewhat summing up my own travels. It's called Pilgrimage. I've been to the Himalayas, searching with 100,000 full-length prostrations for roads that led to Lhasa. I've wandered the hills of the Lake District, seeking the magic words of distant poets in the hopes that they would inspire a few of my own. I've sailed the oceans to find even more distant seers, myself in Zen robes, or covered in the ribbons of secret initiations, or the beaded headdresses of temptresses, muttering a 1,000 mantra. Yesterday, I paused at the step of our small vinyl-sided cottage, myself in gumboots and shabby garden clothes. The smells from the kitchen cheered my spirit, and glimpses of the well-worn recycled furniture appeased my Puritan instinct, and glimpses of the works that we have created remind me of the energies that needed to bring the golem to life. And suddenly, aware of the wealth within, I took my simple pilgrimage over the threshold.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again.
Thank you very much.